You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. We are back from our summer break with a jam-packed episode for you. We speak to Brighton-based Chloe Michelle Howard about her debut novel Sunburn, out now with Verve Books, a beautiful sapphic coming-of-age story set in rural Ireland in the 1990s. To former Brighton resident Emma Claire Wilson about her debut novel This Child of Mine, out now with Avon, about what it was like to grow up in Brighton's old ship hotel and how the inspiration for her emotional novel came about. We talk to Corinne Pellman about this year's first graphic novel competition, which originated with a small Brighton publisher. It's now open to entries, and we catch up with award-winning writer of this month's book club book, Claire Fuller, about the memory of animals. We talk about everything from writing a pandemic novel to octopuses and flu camp. She also gives us an exclusive about her new book. The book club is also available as a podcast where you can download from wherever you get yours. You can follow us on Instagram at BTM Book Club and read the podcast show notes for links and information about everything we talk about on this month's show. Enjoy! It's the early 1990s, and in the Irish village of Crossmore, Lucy feels out of place. Despite her fierce friendships, she's always felt this way, and the conventional path of marriage and motherhood doesn't appeal to her at all. Not even with handsome and doting Martin, her closest childhood friend. Lucy begins to make sense of herself during a long hot summer when a spark with her school friend Susanna escalates into an all-consuming infatuation and, very quickly, to a desperate and devastating love. Fearful of rejection from her small and conservative community, Lucy begins living a double life, hiding the most honest parts of herself in stolen moments with Susanna. But with the end of school and the opportunity to leave Crossmore looming, Lucy must choose between two places, two people, and two futures, each as terrifying as the other. Neither will be easy, but only one will offer her happiness. Chloe, welcome to the Brighton Book Club, and congratulations on the publication of this gorgeous book.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be on.
How does it feel to have your first book out in the world and gaining such great reviews and responses?
It's really surreal, to be honest. I think it's been out just under a month, and I still kind of, I can't quite believe it, especially when people who I don't know tell me that they've read it. Like if I get a message on Instagram, I'm like, how did you find out about this? How did you get a copy of this? So it's very surreal, but I'm really enjoying it.
Why did you decide to set this in the early 1990s? Because after doing a bit of research on you, you were hardly born.
Yeah, that's right. So I was born in 96. So I didn't actually experience the 90s. I certainly wasn't a teenager then. However, I think there's several reasons, to be honest with you. I love the aesthetic of Ireland in the 90s, rural Ireland in the 90s especially. I think it's like just such a specific, comforting aesthetic to me. So I found it very enjoyable to write about and very enjoyable to, you know, describe and just sort of get lost in that world. Also, it was a really interesting time for queer people in Ireland. There was lots and lots of progress being made legally, let's say, like official progress, but not necessarily actual social change happening. So I thought that would be very interesting to explore. And also, I don't really like writing when books where people have mobile phones, and because the characters are teenagers for most of this, I knew it had to be sort of earlier than the 2000s. So that was another big reason that I chose the 90s.
That's so interesting. Where do you think that comes from? Because like, I mean, so many plots now, you know, famous plots just wouldn't happen if phones are involved.
Well, that's exactly, I think, why I don't like doing it, because I think with this book, even if the characters had had phones, I would say most of their troubles would have been avoided. Things could be kept very, very secret. Conflicts can be solved much quicker. You don't have as much time to yourself to think about things. So I do think in storytelling, I would like to avoid the phones as much as possible.
Now feels like a great time for us to hear some. Can you read us an extract?
Of course. So this is from quite early on in the book. It's just a look into Lucy, our protagonist's way of thinking. It's herself and her friends after school one day gossiping, and you just get an idea basically of what their friend group is like. So apparently Niamh Mac has got two dates. Two dates? Well, for some. Yeah, Sean asked her first, of course, but now John is after asking her as well, apparently. Imagine choosing John over Sean. Bernadette's eyes are stuck on me while I eat. Would you be well? Yeah, well, apparently she did. As if anybody would choose anyone over Sean. A sigh falls over the table at the thought of Sean O'Sullivan, 6'2" footballer, eldest of three sons. Sean could ask me to cross the road with him and I'd die, never mind asking me to the Debs. Stop, he's so cool, Susanna says through a bite of her burger, chewing with her mouth open. I watch the meat at his, as it is reduced to mush on her tongue. The girls all laugh. Susanna has connections with the older boys. They all know her because of her brothers. She does not disclose the details of these connections, but she knows how to talk to them. She knows how to talk to everybody. Somehow she knows exactly what everybody wants to hear. Poor old John. Yeah, but would you listen? Apparently she said yes to both of them. She could be asked by a third fella yet. She nearly could. I'd nearly ask her. I only say it as a joke, but it makes Patricia roll her eyes at me. It seems I cannot say the right thing to her. She's always looking at me like she hates me. It wouldn't bother me much if she does, because she's the least interesting and the least pretty of the girls. The others don't like her either. They've all admitted it, but they won't stand by it. I think we would get on fine without her. Even before all the misfortune in her life, Patricia wasn't a nice girl, but we've known her for so long that she's unshakable. Sometimes knowing someone for a long time is the only reason you'd be friends with them. It isn't much of a bond, and still it's unbreakable. Patricia's father is a lot older than her mother. He's in the early days of dementia. Between her husband and her young twins, Patricia's mother does not have time for her. The younger twin did not have enough oxygen at birth. They weren't sure if he'd live. He requires a great deal of care now, as does the other twin, as do all 5-year-olds. It means that Patricia lives a very lonely life at home. When she's headed for college, she will feel guilty for leaving her mother with so much, but she won't let it stop her from leaving. Sometimes her father doesn't recognize her. These times are becoming more frequent. Susanna feels a deep sympathy for her. Sometimes they spend hours together, just the two of them, talking very seriously about life with half parents. I only put up with Patricia because she understands a part of Susanna that I do not. I want Susanna to feel understood. Although when Patricia is sitting in the chipper rolling her eyes at me, I forget to feel sorry for her. It might make me sound callous, but I have no patience left for her. Everyone else laughs at what I said about Niamh. They all know that the chance to spend any time at all with Niamh would be heaven sent. I'd ask her if I wouldn't look so ugly next to her. Joan laughs, and everyone laughs with her, and I just won't look at Patricia anymore today. It's the small punishment she deserves, which she might not even notice. Does that make me an awful person? I don't think her hardships are an excuse for treating me badly. I sometimes wonder if I'm the only one who thinks Patricia is a nasty girl or who remembers that she's always been this nasty. All I did was make a joke. Everyone has moved on but me. I'll keep my mouth shut a while in case I say something else stupid. It's nice to get engrossed in the girls' imaginations while they talk about Niamh and her dress and how Sean will compliment her so well. It's nice to watch them and hear them and feel I am one of them. Although it's comforting, we've had this conversation so many times, and without staying engaged, I find my attention drifting from the table and focusing more plainly on Susanna's mouth. The girl's chatter is only a beehive buzzing near my ears, but I hear very loudly her teeth cutting through her food, the slap of her tongue off the roof of her mouth, the squelching of her spit raising 100 decibels with every bite. Must she eat like a dog? My cheeks redden, but I make no moves to conceal this. And in a wild moment of abandonment, something I've never known before, I think, I would be the microbes in the beef that her body seeks and destroys if it meant she would be paying me even the slightest bit of attention, the warmth and wet of her mouth. What a thought to think! How suddenly and vehemently I think it, how hot my cheeks are. It makes perfect sense to want to be inside her mouth, to be torn to pieces by her, until I catch myself wanting it, and I am shocked, I am disgusted. I almost laugh at my own absurdity. That wasn't me at all. Just a bad notion that got into my head to make trouble. That wasn't me who thought that. What a weird feeling. Very discreetly, I bless myself and hope to be forgiven, and I hope that I never feel anything so inexplicable or strong again. Lucy! I look up. They are talking to me. John or Sean, I said. Blessed be this tired conversation. I could have stopped listening for a year and I would still know what I'm supposed to say. It's easy. These are my people. Waiting for me to say the words and feed their hungry hearts. I understand these girls. I follow the pattern. It's all right. I give them what they want. Sean, every time. They're drowned in a frenzy of giggles, and I let it wash over me. And as I see her mouth hanging open in laughter, I thank every angel in heaven that Susanna has swallowed her food.
That's so fabulous, Chloe. Thank you so much. Your voice is so strong. It's such a joy to read. And I would love to know who inspires your writing. Your prose is so, so beautiful.
Thank you. Gosh, I feel like I have a lot of varied inspirations. But someone I always go back to is Nabokov. I think his writing is so lyrical and beautiful. I think I first read him maybe when I was in uni. Lolita was the first book of his that I read. And it's something that I go back to all the time. Like, I'll just pick a random page and read it. And the way he describes things, I mean, it's gorgeous. It's like, that's like an epic poem almost rather than a book. So I think he's like one of my main literary influences. But also then just real conversations and the way that people speak and funny little things that people say, I'll often write down and, you know, slot in somewhere. So yeah, I try and strike the balance between like very, very lyrical and also words that are based in reality.
Absolutely. No, that really, really comes across. So one of the big themes in the book is the kind of tension between, you know, moving away from where you're from. And I know that now you live in Brighton. Was some of that reflected in your writing of Sunburn?
Do you know, maybe so. It wasn't intentionally done, but I had a similar thing to Sunburn where I was living in the country and I moved to Dublin. And I think maybe after I moved away from Dublin, and it might've actually been a way for me to process the feelings of moving away in hindsight, if that makes sense. But to be honest, by the time I moved to Brighton, we were kind of coming out of lockdown and I was like, oh my God, get me out of the country. I need something new. There was no big emotional goodbye. I was like, I'm out of here.
So how do you feel being a writer in Brighton? We've got so many great writers down here.
Do you know, it's such a fabulous place for creatives generally. I mean, you literally just need to walk out your door and you're going to see such colourful streets and such interesting people. There's no lack of inspiration. Also, I think it's fabulous to be in a city, such a diverse city, and yet still be so near the seaside. Mm-hmm. So you really do have that sort of piece of nature there as well. I do think it's like an endlessly inspiring place. And because there's so many creatives here, it really encourages me to continue to be creative. Like, I feel like I can't really let myself get lazy, you know, because I know that there's so much buzz happening around, and I just, it's nice to feel like you're part of it.
Absolutely. Do you have favorite places that you like to read and write?
Favorite places to read down at the beach. I love writing at the beach, reading at the beach here in Brighton. Even when it's like you're lying on the pebbles and it's super uncomfortable, I feel like once you get into the groove of it, I could stay down there all day reading. I do most of my writing at home, to be honest. I wish I was one of those people that could go to a cafe and write at the cafe and have a coffee. I think it's such a vibe, but I think I'd get way too distracted, so I have to just close myself into my bedroom. But I have a nice view of like the North Lanes from my room, so I just peek out the window and see what everyone's doing and let that kind of inspire me.
Oh, lovely. So can you tell us about what you're working on next?
Yeah, I'm writing something it's quite different to Sunburn. I've sort of left the teenage coming of age, figuring out your sexuality part of it behind. But I'm hoping to keep the intensity and the emotions and the complexities and the inner dialogue. I don't want to say too much because it's sort of in flux at the moment, but it is quite different to Sunburn, I'll say that.
Well, Chloe, thank you so much for joining us on the show. How can people find and follow you and grab a copy of Heartburn?
So my Instagram is Chloe Michelle H. I'm mainly active on there. I do have a Twitter also, which is Chloe M. Howarth. And Sunburn is available in Waterstones, but also in lots of independent bookshops. So I would say support small and support local if you'd be interested to buy it.
And thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before I bring on our next guest, I want to give you a quick warning that in this conversation, we do mention pregnancy loss. So if you know you don't want to hear about that today, do change your radio channel or fast forward your podcast for about the next 12 minutes. But please do come back. So Emma Claire Wilson, former Brighton resident, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. Thank you very, very much for having me. I'm really excited to be joining you today.
Tell us about your debut novel, This Child of Mine.
So This Child of Mine is an emotional fiction novel, commercial women's fiction. It was recently released. It's my debut novel. And it focuses on Stephanie as my main character, who is finally pregnant with a much longed for child. Her and her husband have been trying for a very long time to have a child. When unfortunately she reaches 16 weeks pregnant and is diagnosed with a condition that means that she has to choose between the life of her child and her own life. So it's an incredibly emotional novel, but it is filled with an awful lot of hope. So although it is one of those books that will make you cry from pretty much from page one, it is one that will hopefully leave you feeling very hopeful and happy come the end of the novel.
Where did the inspiration come from for this?
Actually, that's a really difficult question for me to answer, and it's one that I'm asked consistently. So I've had to try and come up with a way of answering it where I'm not giving too many spoilers away. The inspiration from the novel is actually came from my own child. Although the book is not autobiographical, there are an awful lot of issues that are tackled within the novel that are issues that I've had to deal with myself. And actually, the very final scene in the book, which I won't give away by giving any details for, but the actual final scene in the book was a scene that took place between me and someone in my family, my own daughter. So the conversation that happens at the end of the book actually sparked the entire idea for the novel. So once you've read the novel, when you get to the end, you'll be able to see what it was that made me think about that initial question that sparks the idea for a novel in the first place.
Please, can you read some for us?
Of course. This is the first chapter, the first page in the first chapter. So I shall start from there. It was supposed to be the happiest day of my life. I was supposed to bounce out of this chair and follow the sonographer into a room for a follow-up scan to hear the sex of our first child. This was supposed to be the day all of our dreams came true. And I was supposed to have a grin on my face and a heart full of joy and love. But that's not what happened. My heart knew it was coming before anyone else did. Somehow my body knew it too. I could feel it. My heart wasn't racing. In fact, I think it had all but stopped. I couldn't feel anything. My body slipped into self-protection mode and I was simply numb from head to toe. Ms. Jackson, Mr. Jackson, come right through. I tried to rise from the plastic bucket chair, but my legs didn't want to respond. I stood and adjusted my skirt, the hem pricking at the skin on my thighs, as I hazarded a glance towards the girl sat on one of the remaining seats, just a little further down the corridor. Her faithful partner perched just as James had been, like an eager puppy on the very edge of his chair. Her face was so full of hope, a twinkle in her eye like Christmas had come early. Her dream was just beginning. I had the distinct impression all of mine were about to end. I couldn't look towards James. I didn't feel in control of my own body. I knew he was in the room, but I felt like I was watching the scene play out from overhead, detached from a situation I never imagined I would find myself in. Maybe it was self-preservation. I didn't want to see the remnants of hope in his eyes. I knew the panic in mine would kill every prayer he has made these past few weeks. I shuffled forward, not floating, but dragging my terrified body towards the door of doom. I stopped at least three paces short of the door where my feet hit glue that stuck them to the spot. My eyes were unable to move from the clock on the wall. A tiny piece of sellotape was stuck to its edge. Gold shards of plastic tinsel were splayed out from messy angles, a nod to a Christmas past. The aircon that made them the small strips flutter in time with the ticking of the clock. It's August. Don't you know it's bad luck to leave remnants of Christmas decorations up after January? I said. Well, we can't have bad luck here, can we? Dr. Lee replied with a conciliatory smile. I'll make sure the reception takes it down. Too bloody late for me, though, right?
Oh, it's really, really moving right from the get-go. So you have unsurprisingly been compared to Jodi Picoult in your writing, but who else is inspiring for you?
I think there's an awful lot of writers that have inspired me over the years, but it's in quite a strange way, it's not just emotional writers that I tend to find inspiration in. I think the emotional writers that I seem to be drawn to, Amanda Prowse for sure, is one that I always find
manages to tackle really hard-hitting subjects in a really emotional but delicate way. But I think over the years, I really loved the way that Agatha Christie used to weave together novels and how she would pull out fear in people in the same way that I hope to pull out emotion. So I think that I still draw a lot of inspiration from many, many different genres and many different authors. But when it comes to emotional writing, for sure, somebody like Amanda Prowse or more contemporary, I really love Emma Cooper. Her emotional novels have always managed to bring a tear to my eye. So those two for sure.
So a little birdie, i.e. you, tells me that you grew up in Brighton in the Queen's Hotel. Can you tell us about your experience of that and how Brighton has inspired some of the settings in your debut novel?
Brighton is such an important place for me. I moved there as a young child. So I started school, high school and college. My high school and college years were spent in Brighton. And most of my family still live in Brighton. But yes, we did. My parents part owned the Queen's Hotel. So I actually lived inside the Queen's Hotel for quite a number of years in one of the bay windows. So if anybody that knows Brighton really well, the bay windows that overlook the pier, one of those rooms was my bedroom for quite a number of years, and it overlooks the Kissing Post on the seafront. So I used to sit there for hours and hours and hours and just people watch. And a lot of the books and a lot of the writing that I've done has been inspired by the characters I used to watch walking along the seafront and along the promenade and up and down the pier. So a lot of the locations in Brighton are really important to me. And there's a few of the locations that we hit on. Obviously, I mentioned the Kissing Post and the promenade quite a bit, but also Stephanie and James go up to Devil's Dyke as well, which was actually one of my very first places to go for one of my first dates when I was young. So all of these places that meant and held real emotional resonance for me as a child, I put them into this book, and it felt like I was stepping back in time into a place where I felt most emotional during my teenage years, when the sea was all wild and would reflect my moods when I was an angsty teenager, mm-hmm. all the way through to, you know, the beautiful sunny days and the walks along the prom with the guy that I loved hand in hand. So it felt very easy to slip back into an emotional place, setting it somewhere that still to me feels very, very emotional to return to as an adult. So very, very special to me. It's nice to be able to come back and see it as an adult and bring my children back and say, you know, these are the places that influenced my writing. And the Queen's Hotel, for sure, being able to sit in those windows day after day, watching the different types of weather roll past the window and the different people walk past, and the people watching for there for sure, really, really did influence.
Oh, that's so lovely. What a nice most of my writing to the city. So your journey to publication has been quite a long one. You know, you've been writing for a long time. What's your experience of actually being published been like?
Oh, it's insane. I think when you have dreamt so long of being an author, and I've watched so many of my friends and helped so many of my friends get to their publishing dream, that it took me almost 10 years to be brave enough to send out my first novel, despite helping other people behind the scenes send out theirs. That when you're finally here, it's really strange to be on the other side of the curtain. I'm really enjoying it. I love it, but it definitely is a different experience trying to marry the creative side with the business side of it and understanding how the industry works from the inside as well as being a creative that's just writing the books. It's been great. I love it. And I think that anybody has said to me, how are you feeling at the moment? We're almost 2 weeks since publication and I'm exhausted, but I never want to not feel this feeling. It's the most incredible feeling in the world to know that I've finally managed to achieve something that I dreamt about since I was a child, and that actually I'm really enjoying the responses from the readers and feel like this is everything that I had dreamt it would be. So I've had a really lovely run to publication. I think I've been really fortunate so far.
And I know that you are working on your next book. Is there anything you can tell us about this one?
Oh, it's another emotional one. So I'm on a 2-book contract with Avon HarperCollins, and they want something that is again highly emotional for the second one. It is again split across 2 different locations. My first was split across Brighton and Yorkshire. This second novel is actually split between Dundee, which was where I was originally born, and Spain, where I've lived for the last 20 years before I moved back to the UK, and centres a moral question between two families and a secret and an issue that happens between these two families that is either going to tear them apart or bring them back together, but being split across the seas is going to play a big role. So it's not going to make you cry from the very first page, but it absolutely will make you cry. But it, again, is filled with full of hope and focuses a lot more on friendship and the need for friendship during the younger years of family life.
And how can we find and follow you, Emma Claire, and grab a copy of This Child of Mine?
So This Child of Mine is published by Avon HarperCollins. So you can find it in pretty much every online retailer. It's sold on Waterstones and on Amazon. It's in ebook as well as paperback and audio, so those that prefer to listen can listen to the audiobook instead. You can also please try and order through independent bookshops. I love nothing more than trying to help boost small independent publishers and independent bookshops, so please try and order through them instead. But also, if you want to find out more about my writing, I'm mostly active on Twitter at EC Wilson Writer, and my website emmaclairewilson.com. so anybody that would like to know more, follow me on social media. I'm highly active, so you'll be able to find out much more about me on either Twitter or Instagram.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
The first graphic novel competition 2023 is open for entries, and I'm joined by one of the organisers, Corinne Pullman, to tell us more. Corinne, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. What is a graphic novel for anyone unfamiliar?
Well, a graphic novel is a picture book telling a story. In grown-up language, you might say it's a visual narrative, but it's usually a sequence of words and pictures working together to tell a story. It can be without words, but it can't be without pictures. So, and it's also kind of called, you know, you'll have heard the word comic and talking about comic creators. So it's also, the graphic novel is also a long form comic, but you know, comics originally kind of started in the kind of funny papers in the 1890s and so on, and that word has sort of stuck with the form in the UK.
So how did the first graphic novel competition start? Because this is by no means the first time it's been running.
It's actually started in 2012, it was held by the local publisher, Myriad Editions, local to Brighton, and the publisher had the aim of supporting debut authors. Now, and they were running a competition for first time writers, you know, prose novelists. And then I was always kind of working on the graphic novel side of things. And we decided to start a competition for graphic novelists because there are so few publishers who specialize in graphic novels. And the aim was to actually publish the winning entry. We were asking for 15 to 30 pages of a graphic novel in progress. And then the prize was to work with the editorial team at Myriad and see the novel through to publication.
And this is a competition that's really launched the careers for graphic novelists. Just to mention, you know, one local one in particular, Hannah Eaton. And you just don't know whether or not these amazing works would have been discovered without the competition. Who else are big success stories of the competition?
Well, there are several, actually. I mean, it's run roughly every 2 years since it started. So, but I was sort of totted up that there had been over 17 graphic novels published as a result of being shortlisted or winning the competition. I mean, such is the quality of the work. So, kind of one author who's done very well kind of recently is Saba Khan, whose book she was shortlisted in the competition in 2018 with an extract from her graphic novel, a graphic memoir that became The Roles We Play. Gareth Brooks was the first winner of the competition back in 2012, and he's now published another two books since then. And he's, you know, he's become very well known, and kind of several others. I mean, it's really kind of curated a great list of graphic novels.
So you're working with a couple of partners this year. Can you please tell us a bit about them?
Yeah, so I've been very lucky, actually, in having the opportunity of working with new partners, because Myriad itself had to cut back on new commissions in its publishing, so it wasn't really possible to run the award again. So I decided I would kind of look for other partners, and I've been working with Emma Haley at Self-Made Hero. Self-Made Hero is a leading graphic novel publisher in the UK, and it has an international reach and publishes not just British authors but also graphic novelists from sort of overseas. So Emma was very keen, Emma Haley, the director, was very keen to get involved with it. And we've also partnered with the Cartoon Museum, London's Cartoon Museum, which has a kind of brilliant collection of original works of, you know, comics and cartoons from 18th century, and as well as they run a wide range of activities for all ages, really, kind of promoting all aspects of comic arts and graphic novels and so on. And I've had just lots of sort of offers of support somehow, including I've actually got some seed money from the Authors Licensing and Collecting Society, which was a grant that has enabled to pay for some of the expenses in setting up the competitions and, supporting the call out for entries.
That's wonderful. So how can people enter or find out more?
We're looking for 15 to 30 pages of a graphic work in progress, and that can be fiction or non-fiction, reportage, with or without words. And we're looking for graphic novelists who've not had a full-length work commercially published. So you can still be a kind of avid self-publisher if you like. We're also looking for kind of artists who maybe haven't, you know, might be established in another field of art but haven't necessarily wandered into graphic novels. And, you know, maybe those who've been in the field a long time but need to fish out those stories, unfinished stories, from their bottom drawers. So we've got entry forms. There's a website called www.firstgraphicnovel.co.uk. First graphic novel is all one word. And there's lots of information there, all the kind of conditions of entry and the details and the history about previous competitions, and the entry form.
And for anyone listening who is interested in getting into graphic novels, what three would you recommend are good ones to start with?
Oh, well, I always kind of say to people back at them, well, what kind of prose do you normally read? I mean,
I guess for like, let's say a general fiction reader, and then maybe give us one graphic memoir as well.
Well, I think kind of probably the... I think for somebody who's sort of say, you know, how I'm sort of, I think I like graphic novels, I'm not quite sure, how do I get into them? I mean, I think that I still find Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics an incredibly good book into showing how graphic novels actually work and what people, you know, it's looking at the way panels are used or not used and how the kind of words and pictures are working together. And it's, apart from anything else, it's a thoroughly good read. So I think I'd sort of recommend that to somebody at any kind of stage or from any background. I mentioned Sabah Khan's work before, kind of graphic memoir, and that's an example of how her training as an architect has influenced the design of her memoir. Which is a beautiful insight into her identity as a British-born second-generation immigrant, and sort of speaks for an unseen people, if you like. But her, it's the art style that she uses is kind of totally different from that, you know, panel by panel thing that you might envisage if you're thinking of a comic. So that's a real variation. And then I would, yeah, I don't know. There are a couple of books I haven't read, which I'd be really interested in. And that's cheating a bit. But Linda Barry is a very inspirational comics teacher and kind of teaching at university and all ages, and maker of books about comics. And her Making Comics and Syllabus, which is published by Drawn and Quarterly, a very good Canadian publisher, graphic novel publisher. I think that I should read that. I mean, I'm telling me to read that. And I know that kind of she's been hugely influential on other people making comics. So I think that's a good one to go for.
Oh, great. Well, thank you so much, Corinne, for joining us and telling us about the first graphic novel competition, which is open now for entries. Our book club book this month is Claire Fuller's The Memory of Animals. This is an utterly gripping apocalyptic novel which explores grief, guilt and friendship set in a claustrophobic, tense environment. I have yet to read a book by Claire that I haven't loved, and this one was absolutely no exception. So before I bring her on to discuss the book, here is the blurb. Neffy is a young woman running away from grief and guilt and the one big mistake that has derailed her career. When a debilitating new virus sweeps across the globe, volunteering in a vaccine trial offers her a way to make up for her past. But then the virus mutates and the future she had dreamed of herself is gone. As the London streets outside the medical unit fall silent and food begins to run out, Neffy must decide where safety lies. Might she find solace by revisiting her own heady memories of the past? Can she trust the strangers trapped inside with her, despite her growing suspicions? Or is her best chance of a future to be found in the terrifyingly unknown world outside? Claire, welcome back on the show. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
So I know you started writing this book, which is set during a pandemic, before the pandemic happened. When and how did the idea come to you?
Yeah, it was September 2019, and a friend of my son's had come around to the house, and he was telling us about Flu Camp, which was a vaccine trial. Maybe it's still running, I'm not sure, that you could sign up for, and you were given the flu vaccine and the flu virus, and then he had to stay in isolation for a couple of weeks in London, in a unit in London. And you were paid several thousand pounds for doing that. So lots of students did it. And I just thought, what a fascinating idea. Never heard of it before. And what an idea for a premise, maybe, for a novel. So, you know, what if people sign up for a vaccine trial while there is something happening in the rest of the world that kind of traps them there? So, oh, yes, I think I'll write a pandemic novel in September 2019.
And how's the response been from having a pandemic novel out?
Well, my publishers were very happy with it. And some people, I think, you know, are perhaps not reading it because COVID feels too recent. But lots of people are loving it. And the thing is, although, you know, it's easy shorthand to say it's a pandemic novel, in a way, I see it more as a kind of locked room mystery. So Neffy and these other four volunteers are stuck in this unit while there's a pandemic in the rest of the world, but it's the pandemic that's keeping them in this place. And it could almost have been anything that was keeping them in this place. So it's how these people manage together when something awful is happening, rather than it being about a pandemic.
So Neffy is a really wonderfully complex and nuanced character. How did you get into her head and under her skin?
Well, I don't ever plan. I just start writing. And so I dropped Neffy into this medical unit in London, really, and wrote to discover what would happen. So I discovered her and got to know her really through the writing. I mean, that's how it works for me. I write to work out who the characters are and how they're going to behave. And then sometimes, you know, I get a bit stuck. And then I will open another document and I will have a conversation with the character. So I will say to Neffy, you know, what did you think about whatever it was that Leon said to you. And because I don't know in the novel, and then she will reply on the page. Obviously, it's me replying, but it's kind of a way of having a conversation with her and tapping into my subconscious. And that sometimes will bring out all sorts of things.
That is fascinating. So before I get you to read some, the book is sprinkled with flashbacks to Greece. Why did you decide to write about this part of the world?
Well, I was starting writing and I had these five characters in this unit in London, and I thought, I'm going to have to write a whole novel with them stuck there. And how claustrophobic will that be? Because I really love writing descriptions of nature. And I thought, how am I going to get that into this novel? And so she uses this piece of technology to travel back to her own memories, most of which are on the island of Paxos in Greece. And that just allowed me, and then hopefully the reader, to escape what's right in front of her, you know, the terrible things that are happening in the unit and outside, and for me to be able to write descriptions of nature, and then her to meet an octopus and to fall in love with octopuses and to become a marine biologist. So it all kind of works out in the end.
Can you read us some, please, Claire?
Yeah, I'm very happy to. So this is not from the very beginning, it's just from a short way in. So Nefi has volunteered for the trial, she's in the unit. She has a very bad reaction, really, to the vaccine and the virus, and she's unconscious for 3 or so days. When I wake properly for the second time, I feel better, cooler, more rested. In fact, the room is chilly and I pull the duvet up to my chin. The items on the bedside table still haven't changed position. The empty water jug and the plate. The mug with vaccine biofarm on the side. The box of pills is there and the interior blind is still down. The picture of the CNN building has gone from the TV screen and now shows only white text on a black background. Sorry, something has gone wrong. I lower myself off the bed and go back to the exterior window, dragging the duvet with me. The air conditioning is blasting out a fresh breeze, but it's sunny outside. Maybe midday, and when I stare again towards the east, the sun is still rising, only now with a cloud of dark smoke above it. I look and I look, but there's nothing else to see, and no one is in the alleyway, not even any more deer, and no cars or people past the far end, no sirens sound. Using the wall as a prop, I go to the bathroom and stick my head under the tap and drink, gulping down air and water, stopping to belch and then drinking again. I grip the edges of the sink and look in the mirror. I'm shocked to see a whole real human being, as though I were expecting to no longer have a structure, no skin containing bones, but instead something more fluid, slippery, a liquid body that could flow into a dark corner, a desk drawer, a shoe, a drain. My face is even rounder than usual and my skin is dry. I have dark circles around my puffy eyes and the flesh here is tender when I prod it. And when I pull up my top, the colour of my chest is yellowish-green. My stomach too, as though a bruise from a fight I have forgotten about is disappearing, one that covered my entire body. Back in my bedroom, I press my ear to the adjoining wall, listening for the Irish girl laughing or the sound of her TV, but I don't hear anything. How long is it since I've been outside this room or someone has come in? Time has folded in on itself, corners and triangles overlapping and forming dark pockets, and now that I'm trying to uncrease it, it is flattening into a different shape. I make my way around the bed to the door and I press down on the handle, slowly, silently. I don't know what I'm expecting on the other side. I only know that something is very wrong. There is no noise in the corridor. No chatter of the nurses at their station, no rattle of Mike's trolley. The handle depresses, but the door won't open. I turn the twist lock and its clunk is loud, but still the door doesn't release. I give it a final tug and then let go. I try to remember how the door is accessed from the outside. It seems so long since I came in here with Boo. Did she have a key card which she waved in front of a reader or pushed into a slot? Have they locked me in because I was given the virus and tried to leave? That can't be right. I would be given food. I would be checked on. Hello? I say, my cheek pressed to the door, too quietly for anyone to hear. No answer. I pull the duvet closer around my neck and consider pushing the emergency button above the bed or shouting, banging on the door. My fist is raised, about to thump, when the thought arrives. Not that I'm unsure about who might come, but that no one will.
Oh, that's such a great extract. Thank you so much, Claire. So in this book, Neffy is obsessed with octopuses. Why octopuses? And I'd love to find out some things you found out about them in your research.
Yeah, well, I've always loved cephalopods. So octopuses, squid, cuttlefish, ammonites. And before I was a writer, I worked in marketing for many years. And before that, I was a sculptor and I did a degree in sculpture. And the things I often carved, I was a stone carver and a wood carver, were cephalopods. So I have lots of carvings of ammonites and squid and all sorts of things like that. And in fact, when I was 40, I went and had my one and only tattoo, which is of an ammonite. And so I've always loved them. And when I had to find a job for Neffy, you know, she had to be employed doing something. And she had been, I'd been writing her in Paxos, Greece, snorkeling. And it just seemed follow on logically that she should become a marine biologist specializing in octopuses. And then as I started researching them and whether octopuses are in labs being experimented on or in aquaria, there were some parallels between what Neffy was going through and octopuses in tanks, you know, with glass surrounding them, because Neffy is stuck in this unit with just the windows to the outside. And I'd known very little about octopuses when I'd been carving them, because it was all just about the shape rather than about the physiology of an octopus and what it's like. So I did lots of research, and some of that is in the book. And they are absolutely fascinating creatures. I mean, so intelligent. There's all sorts of things, like they really have kind of, I suppose, nine brains, because they have as many kind of neurons in their arms, and they are called arms, not tentacles, as they do in their brain in their head. So that's how they experience the world, through their arms and the suckers. And what else? They have the brain in their head is shaped like a donut and their intestines run through it. I think that's just amazing.
Wow.
And then also some quite awful things about how octopuses are treated and how they're eaten and tenderized in Greece, and how there's a Korean dish where the octopuses are eaten alive, still kind of wriggling on the plate. And yeah, some quite distressing things really too. My aim is that anyone who reads this book will never eat octopus again.
Yeah, that has definitely worked for me. So all your books are really different, Claire. As an author that doesn't necessarily fit into one kind of genre box, is it every book published is just a completely different experience for you?
Not desperately, because there's still, you know, the promotion to do. You still, you know, interact with readers, you still meet booksellers, you know, all those kinds of things. But I suppose what you don't know is how it will be received. And also, you know, lots of people found me as an author through Unsettled Ground, my previous book, which won the Costa Novel Prize. And so I think some people expect me to write the same book again, and I don't do that. So anyone who found me through Unsettled Ground, I kind of say brace yourself, because The Memory of Animals is a very different book. But I'm just not that interested in genre. I just write what I'm interested in, what I want to write, and my publishers seem very happy with that. So, you know, I'm halfway through the next thing and it seems to be a ghost story.
Well, that was my next question. A ghost story. Excellent. Can you tell us anything more?
Yeah, it has a working title of Ursula, and it is about a young woman called Ursula in 1987. And she works in the post room of an art school. So it is the art school that I went to, but she's very much kind of an outsider looking in. And she becomes an artist, but also before that, really, she he kills someone accidentally, well, kind of accidentally, and they haunt her, not just psychologically, but actually haunt her. Yeah.
Sounds amazing. Well, I will definitely be reading it. So, Claire, how can we find and follow you?
Well, I'm on Twitter for the time being, but mostly I use Instagram, where I'm writer Claire Fuller. And then there's also my website, which is clairefuller.co.uk. Yeah, I'm on Instagram mostly, and mostly posting about books that I've read. So for me, Instagram is all about kind of recommendations and finding other books that I want to read, rather than particularly my own work.
What have you read recently that you'd really recommend to our listeners?
I Have Some Questions for You by Rebecca Mackay for my book group that I'm in. And I did really enjoy that. But enough for me to go back and look at her previous novel, which I think was shortlisted for the Pulitzer, which is called The Great Believers, which I absolutely love. I mean, it's very likely to be kind of in my top 10 books of the year, even though it was published a little while ago. It's about the gay community in Chicago in the 1980s and being devastated by the AIDS virus, and following one particular person who works in a gallery acquiring work, and then seeing a friend of his several years later in Paris when she's trying to find the daughter that she's estranged with. It's so moving and so brilliantly written. I do love a book that I can cry with. I cried a lot with this book.
Oh, thank you so much. It's always so great to have recommendations, especially from voracious readers, which I know you are. So thank you so much, Claire, for coming on the show. And Claire's most recent book, The Memory of Animals, is out now with Penguin. Thank you for tuning in. Our next book club book is Eliza Clark's Penance, out now with Faber. We adored Eliza's Boy Parts and cannot wait to get stuck in her next novel, which is getting rave reviews already. Here is the blurb. Do you know what happened already? Did you know her? Did you see it on the internet? Did you listen to a podcast? Did the hosts make jokes? Did you see pictures of the body? Did you look for them? It's been nearly a decade since the horrifying murder of 16-year-old Joan Wilson rocked Crowansea, and the events of that terrible night are now being published for the first time. That story is Penance, a dizzying feat of masterful storytelling where Eliza Clark manoeuvres us through the accounts from the inhabitants of this small seaside town, placing us in the capable hands of journalist Alex Z. Corelli. Clark allows him to construct what he claims is the definitive account of the murder and what led us to it. Built on hours of interviews with witnesses and family members, painstaking historical research, and most notably correspondence with the killers themselves, the result is a riveting snapshot of the lives rocked by tragedy and a town left in turmoil. The only question is, how much of it is true? Penance is available now from all good bookshops, but why not order it from Brighton's Waterstone, City Books, or the Feminist Bookshop? We will be back next month with another show packed full of exciting Brighton-based authors and news from New Writing South about the iconic Coast is Queer Festival. As ever, you can get in touch with us and send us your pitches and ideas by emailing us at btmbookclub@gmail.com and follow us on Instagram at btmbookclub. If you are a podcast person, please do rate, review and subscribe. It makes all the difference to us. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you next month. I am really excited to hear that Brighton's Independent Beer Crawl is back, this time for a summer version from August 25th to the 28th, 2003. That is that bank holiday weekend in August, one of my favourite weekends of the year. Takes place across Brighton and Hove. The Beer Crawl sees 15 of Brighton's best independent pubs join in with Verdant Brewing and Pressure Drop for a citywide tap takeover. These are two of the UK's best independent breweries, and they will be collaborating on a very special pale ale exclusively available for the event. So what is Brighton's Independent Beer Crawl, you may ask? Participants get a stamp for buying a drink in each site on the Beer Crawl map across the weekend. Prizes are then available and a party will be hosted on the Saturday. The venue for that is to be confirmed. So they started November's Beer Crawl in response to the increasing number of chains opening across Brighton. So coming from a background of a proudly independent business, they wanted to support other like-minded pubs, and its success ensured that Brighton's Independent Beer Crawl will be bigger and better. The sites will cover the whole city from Madeira Drive all the way to Hanover and Hove. Maps will be available from Beer Crawl sites across the start of August, and participants are encouraged to take their time visiting each pub. It lasts 4 days, so there's no rush, and no one wants anyone to get a sore head in that lovely August sun. I will be there enjoying a glass or two of lovely pale ale, and you can follow the team and find out which pubs are participating on Instagram at BTN Independence Beer Crawl. Hope to see you there.